One had a problem in his business. At a different house, he heard someone talking about a problem that required government assistance, and he was having a hard time with that. Everybody had a different worry, but every single house had worries. One night, though, the king saw a very low house. It was almost like a cellar built half underground, and it had windows at ground level. The roof was broken and sagging. And he looked inside, and there was a man playing his fiddle. And the king had to listen very carefully just to hear the music. And this man was very happy. He had a jug of wine and various foods in front of him, and he was very happy. He was full of joy, no worries at all. And the king, who was in disguise, went into the house and asked the man how he was doing. And the man invited this stranger to sit down, and the king saw the wine and the various foods, and he saw how joyful this man was. And the man served his guest a drink, and he drank a toast to him. And the king took a liking to this guy, and he drank the toast. He was happy to be there. And he laid down, he fell asleep. And he could see that this man was the only one he had found who was completely happy and with no worries at all. In the morning, the king woke up, and so did the man. And the man walked the king out of the house. And the king said to him in disguise, "Where did you get all this food and everything?" And the man said, "I know how to repair things. I can repair anything that's broken. I can't make anything from scratch, but if something gets broken, I know how to fix it. And every morning I go out and I repair a few things. And then, after I've earned 6 shillings, I buy all this food and drink for myself, and I go home and I have a great time." When the king heard this, he said to himself, "I'm going to screw this up for this guy. I'm going to spoil this for him." So he went back to the palace, took off his disguise and got dressed up in his king outfit, and issued a decree forbidding anyone in the kingdom who had something in need of repair from giving it to someone else to repair. If something broke, you either had to fix it yourself or get a new one. Kind of like these days, you can't find anybody to repair anything. So, in the morning, the man went out looking for people with things that needed to be repaired. And every time he found a person like that, they told him, "Well, the king decreed that it's forbidden to give anything to anyone else to repair." And the man at first was very upset by this, but he had trust in God. And he was walking along, and he noticed a householder chopping wood. "Why do you have to chop this wood?" he asked him. Look at you, you're an important person. Should you have to be chopping wood?" And the householder said, "Well, I tried to find someone, but I couldn't find anyone, so I have to do it myself." "Give it to me," the man said, "I'll chop it for you." And he chopped the wood, and the householder paid him 1 shilling. And the man saw that this was a good way to earn a living. So he went around and chopped more wood until he earned 6 shillings. And then he was able to buy his entire meal, and it was a really good meal, and he was very happy. That night, the king came again and looked into the window of the man's house, and he saw him sitting there with his food and drink before him in a very happy mood. And just like the previous night, the king went in and enjoyed with the man and fell asleep, and in the morning got up and they went outside, and the king said, "Where did you get all of this stuff? You need money to buy this. Where did you get the money?" And the man said, "Well, I used to repair things that were broken, but the king passed a decree prohibiting giving anything out to someone else for repair. So I chopped wood until I earned enough money for this. Well, the king went back to the palace, and guess what he did? He issued a decree that nobody could get someone else to chop their wood. So the next day, when the man went out to chop wood, the person told him, the king issued a decree that nobody can chop wood for anybody else. And the man was upset about this because he had no money, but he did have trust in God. So off he went. And as he was walking along, he noticed somebody cleaning out a stable. And he said, you know, it's not fitting for you to be cleaning out the stable after all. You're an important person. You shouldn't be having to do that. And the man said, well, I was looking for someone to clean it out, but I couldn't find anybody, so I have to do it myself. Let me do it. I'll do it for you. And he set to work, and he cleaned out the whole stable, and the owner gave him 2 shillings. And he went and cleaned more stables, and pretty soon he had 6 shillings, and he bought a whole feast, and he went home. And the meal was a meal, and he was really happy. And once again, the king came around to look and see what was going on, and once again he saw that everything was just as it was before. The king went inside and again stayed the night, and in the morning, again, the man walked the king out. The king said, how did you manage to get money to do this? And the man explained that the king had issued a decree making it forbidden to employ anyone else to clean out one stable. The next day, the king, right, issued that decree. So, next day the man figured he was now a stable cleaner, but he found out that no, it had been decreed that he couldn't do that. Well, the man went to the king's recruiting officer to sign up as a soldier in the king's army because that was the last thing that he could think of to do. Nothing else was possible. So he went there to sign up for the army. Now, some soldiers are conscripted for army service, but others are hired as soldiers and they get paid for that. And so the man went to the recruiting officer and signed up for payment, volunteered, in other words, for payment. However, he made a deal with the recruiting officer that he was not signing up permanently, just for a little while until things changed. And the very important thing was that he was to receive his pay each morning for that day's work. And the man agreed. And so dressed him up in an army uniform and gave him a sword at his side and sent him somewhere to serve in the army. And he served that day, and he came home in the evening, having completed his duties and been paid. He threw off his uniform and went home to buy his whole meal, and the meal was a meal. And he went home and he was very happy. And the king came and saw this. The king was astonished. Ate the meal, went to sleep, next morning, woke up. How did you manage this? And the man told him what he had done. The next day, the king summoned the recruiting officer, and he said to him, you are not to pay wages to anyone at all today. And that morning when the man went to the recruiting officer to collect his day's pay, the officer didn't give it to him. And he said, but wait, I made a condition. We agreed that you would pay me every day. And the man said, well, yes, but the king has decreed that I cannot pay anyone today. And the man pleaded with him, but it didn't work. I'll pay you tomorrow, and I'll give you 2 days' pay, the officer said. But today, I just can't pay you. What did the man do? He had a sword. He broke off the blade of the sword from its handle and replaced it with a piece of wood that was in the shape of the sword. And when he put the sword in the sheath, of course, you couldn't tell that it was wood. And now he had a piece of metal that was valuable, and he went and sold the metal, and he made enough money to have his meal. The king arrived that night, and he was now completely flabbergasted that the guy was, just as always, happy and eating his meal and drinking his wine and playing his fiddle. And the king said, "How did you manage this?" And the man told him the whole story, how he'd been forced to break the blade of the sword from the handle, and how he had pawned it in order to buy what he needed for the meal. He said, "And afterward, when I receive the pay for that day, the 2 days, I will redeem the blade and repair the sword because I can fix everything. So I'll repair the sword, it'll be good as new, and no one will ever know. And the king will not have lost a piece of his, you know, army equipment, and it'll be fine." So the next day the king went to his palace and called a recruiting officer. And he told him that there was a person in the kingdom that had been condemned to death. And he said, "I want you to call a particular soldier, not just any soldier, but a particular soldier, and order him, and only him, to cut off the condemned man's head." So the officer summoned the fixer, this guy. And now the king appeared, dressed in his kingly costume, and gave instructions for all his ministers to assemble in order to witness this comic spectacle exposing a man who stuck a piece of wood in his sword in place of the blade. So nobody was going to get killed because the king understood that it was a wooden sword, but he was going to humiliate the fixer. So he came before the king and fell down at the king's feet and said, "My lord, why have I been summoned here? In order to cut off this condemned man's head," replied the king. The man pleaded that he had never in his life shed blood, and he begged the king to call somebody else to do this. And the king answered that he and no one else was obliged to kill the man. And the fixer said, "Well, but is the verdict 100% sure? Maybe it's not so clear that he's guilty. I have never shed blood in my life. How could I shed blood when it's not clear that the prisoner deserves to die?" And the king said, "There is not a shadow of a doubt. This prisoner is guilty and deserves to die. And you and nobody else must execute him." Well, the man saw that he could not prevail over the king, so he turned to God, and he said to God, he made a prayer right then and there. He said, "Eternal God, never in my life have I shed blood. If this man is not guilty, let the blade of my sword turn into wood." What's that? He said, he's praying to God, "Dear God, never in my life have I shed blood. If this man is not guilty, let the blade of my sword turn into wood." So he drew his sword from his scabbard, from the sheath, and lo and behold, everybody could see that it was made of wood. And everybody had a good laugh, even the king, who saw that this was an excellent person, and he sent him off in peace. And that's the story of the fixer who trusted in God. So this is a great story, right? I really love this story. And it's very lighthearted, and it's almost a joke story, but it's also profound. As in many of Rabbi Nachman's story, God appears in the character of a king. In this case, a king who is curious about his subjects and wants to engage with them. He wants to understand them, so he puts some tests to see what they're going to do. And the story begins very explicitly with God's great happiness. God makes the whole world out of nothing, and it is good, as we read. So how could God have any worries? God is very happy. God has no worries. Yet somehow, God is unable to leave it at that. In Rabbi Nachman's world, God is constitutionally unable to leave the world alone, to observe the world at a distance. God feels compelled, possibly out of love, possibly out of curiosity, possibly simply because this is the nature of the Jewish God. God is compelled to go forth and investigate and engage with people. Maybe like a parent who sneaks into their son or daughter's room when they're in college to see how they're doing. Can't stop meddling, you know. And since human beings are the most curious of all the creatures, God pokes into human lives above all and discovers, to his surprise maybe, that human beings just are not happy. Every single one of them has problems and worries. But then the king happens upon a pit, an underground house, in which he finds the one satisfied man. And this man enjoys himself and enjoys his humanness, enjoys his eat and his drink, because he realizes his limitations. As he says, I can't make anything from scratch like God can. I can only fix things. In other words, this is a man who knows that everything is given, not earned, and everything is breakable. Maybe the other people, the ones with all the worries, don't know this. Maybe they imagine the world should be perfect, unbroken, and every day they're complaining because they find that it's not. And they don't trust God in the way the fixer does. So when things go wrong, they are really worried. They're worried that if things are bad, they'll be worse. But this man knows that God has made a breakable world, and that's what his livelihood depends on. So he can cope with this. It's his whole stock in trade, and he's content living in a given, broken world. And that's what he does. He takes on the world's brokenness every single day. He fixes stuff, knowing that the next day there'll be more stuff to fix, and I'll have to fix stuff the next day too. He's not disappointed by this. In fact, he depends on it. He thrives on it. That's where his food and drink comes from. And his life is really simple. He possesses nothing. Every day he makes just enough to live for that day. I think the other people, the worried ones, have a lot more than he does. But they are never content. Now the king engages in a kind of contest with this man. He tests him. But it's very different from the other famous test case that we have, Job. the tone of this test case is completely the opposite. Here, no one really suffers, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of anguish. And the story ends with a good joke. Because this fixer, simple as he is, has an unshakable faith in God. And he doesn't rely only on that. He's also quite resourceful. He's not a passive person waiting for God to do things for him. He knows how to roll with the punch, but he trusts. And when adversity comes his way, and God in the story gives him several strong moments of adversity, he's upset, but only at first. Pretty soon he adjusts and he goes forth trusting that something will happen. And he finds a way. He never kvetches. Never. Maybe he's not Jewish. The story doesn't actually say whether he's Jewish, so maybe he's not Jewish. And the character of the fixer reminds me a lot of something that's very famous in the Buddhist tradition, the tradition of the bodhisattva. Have you heard about bodhisattvas? They're sort of imaginary beings who are committed to going on practicing every single day, forever and ever and ever, for the benefit of others. That's all they want to do and all they ever do. One of the six practices of bodhisattvas is virya paramita, the perfection of joyful effort. They just keep making effort, like the Energizer Bunny, you know, they're just happy to do it. Another practice of the six practices of bodhisattvas is called kshanti paramita, the perfection of patience, patient endurance. When bad things happen, bodhisattvas don't get down about it, they just use it for the path. And doesn't this sound just like the fixer? His faith in God doesn't depend that things should go well. No matter what happens, he trusts and he just keeps on going straight ahead. He just is happy to live and enjoy his life. Every day there's a new problem, and that's fine. Remember, the man doesn't live in a normal house. He lives underground in a pit, it says. Now, Rabbi Nachman's most famous story, which I find so complicated and convoluted that it's impossible to comprehend, is called The Seven Beggars. And in that story, toward the beginning, a boy and a girl get married in a pit. Odd place for a wedding, but that's where they get married. Now, Hanukkah is coming, this retreat, right? It'll be a lot of joy to light the Hanukkah candles. On the Shabbos of Hanukkah, we read Parsha Miketz, which is not the whole of, but a part of the Joseph story. Joseph is thrown into a pit by his brothers. A terrible thing, right? It's terrible enough to be thrown into a pit, but to be thrown into a pit by your own brothers, that's pretty bad. What a horrible betrayal. Which, as we later find out, turns out to be a really good thing. Because, by an amazing and unexpected twist of fate, Joseph is able to save Egypt and the whole world and his family because he seems to have a knack for channeling God's ability to interpret dreams, and because of that, all of this happens. What his brothers did was really, really terrible. But as we know from the story, later on he's able to forgive them. Because, for one thing, he feels their true remorse. But besides, look at how this terrible thing turned out. So terrible things happen, and they're really terrible. But then other things happen. And you don't know how that's going to turn out. And then something always happens after that and after that. So the pit. The pit is the place you never wanted to go. The pit is the place where what you never ever wanted to see happen happens. That's the pit. And yet, we don't know how it turns out. Now, when you're in the pit, it's dark. It's terrible. There's nothing good to be said about it. You can't even imagine anything other than the darkness of the pit. And you imagine the future, and all there is in the future is darkness. As we know, it's a kind of a lucky break that Joseph gets out of the pit, gets taken to Egypt, and he's doing pretty well in Egypt, and whoops, now he's in prison, right? And he's never going to get out of there. But then, whoops, a lucky break, and before you know it, he's practically the ruler of Egypt. And he's able to save his family from starvation. Whoops! Before you know it, they're slaves in Egypt. Whoops! Before you know it, they get out of Egypt and they receive Torah. And what happens next? Maybe we're all in the pit right now. We haven't really been talking about it, but maybe America is in a pit. Possibly America's in a pit. Maybe Israel is in a pit. The whole world really might be in a serious pit. And any one of us can be in a pit when something happens in our lives that's the last thing we wanted to have happen to us. But the pit is also the place where we marry, where we betroth ourselves to God. Possibly there is no avoiding the pit. Possibly we need to fall into the pit. Possibly when we think we're not in the pit, actually we are. The fixer lives in the pit and is happy there. Now, you probably all have heard of Rabbi Alan Liu, who was my dear, dear friend and spiritual companion, and we started a Jewish meditation center together 25 years ago. And it's the 25th anniversary of that center, which is why we have to go home, and we're having a 25th anniversary retreat and celebration as soon as I go home. One of his most surprising teachings, which I'm not sure I ever heard anybody else give, because as you know, we all say the same stuff. Everybody knows the things we say. It's very unusual to hear something that you haven't heard before a million times. But possibly you've never heard this. He said that meditation practice is an artificially induced pit. Did you hear that? Maybe you can appreciate that, right? So far. We're all so cheerful and nice, but we know you're suffering. You know how hard it is to sit there. So yeah, meditation practice is an artificially induced pit, a homeopathic pit, right? And although we like to talk about meditation as so peaceful and so renewing and so happy, which I hope it is, and I have no doubt that by the time you leave here, you'll feel that way. Nevertheless, in the middle of a retreat, it doesn't always feel that way. It can often feel a bit like a pit. And this is one of the things about meditation practice that I think is really, really valuable and important, is that the meditation practice opens you to the darkness. Sometimes it plunges you into the darkness you wanted to avoid. It allows the darkness. And the darkness is really important. So maybe we don't have to suffer a terrible loss or be anguished over the state of the world to be in the pit. Just sit here long enough. That's why, you know, I feel sorry for people who think, well, this is getting a little hard, I take a little break, take the afternoon off. I feel sorry for you if you do that. Because it's good to be in the pit. It really helps you. So if we sit here long enough, we're going to be in crisis one way or the other. But it's a controlled crisis, and we're supported in the crisis. So it's a safe thing. And that's how you learn, and that's how you grow. And then, because it's homeopathic pit-ishness, what means by that is that when, I'm sorry to say, it happens, and it will, that you're walking along minding your own business and you fall into a pit in your life, you will be ready. You will be able to handle it much better because of all the homeopathic pit treatment that you have received from your meditation practice. You will have developed, if you show up and do it, even when you'd rather, it's a little getting hard, take a little time off, but no, you show up anyway. You develop Kshanti Paramita. You develop the practice of patient endurance. And then you can face what happens. So this fixer lives in a pit. And not only does he not mind it, he seems to enjoy it. And every day he goes forth and he fixes things. And then in the evening, he returns to the pit. He has a meal and he's happy. And should the king show up to visit in disguise, he's ready for the king. He's got a little extra food and a bed. And when the king says, no, fixing things is illegal, then there are other things to be done. How does he do these things, these other things? How does he find these other things? He finds them by practicing loving respect for other people. That's what he does. He's humble, and he's all-around helpful guy. Oh, gee, you know, you shouldn't have to chop your own wood. That's not good for you. I'll do it. Oh, man, you're not a person who should be cleaning out stables. Let me do it. I actually think that as much as we strive for these things, spiritually, having a lot of money and a big identity is not good for you. I really believe that. Getting out of the pit and thinking you're out of the pit is not good. You should be humble. You should really think that you're nothing. And you should look around at everybody else that you see anywhere, in any station in life, and think that that other person is a dignified and special person, and that you yourself are there to see that. And all you want to do is just live another day, take care of yourself the best you can, and try to help out all these other really fantastic people that you see pretty much everywhere you look. That's the way you enjoy your life. That's the secret of this man's enjoyment. And if, unluckily enough for you, you do have a big position in life and a lot of money, you should remember, you didn't really earn it, actually. It was luck more than anything else. Maybe you did something, but you know, without the right circumstances, it wouldn't have happened. It was actually just a gratuitous act of nature. And anyway, it's not really yours. It's not really you. And anyway, before you know it, it'll all be gone. So just remember that. And then enjoy it. Enjoy it. And you won't have to be embarrassed or feel guilty about it. This is not the fixer's problem. He doesn't take himself very seriously. He's a simple person, no ambitions, just wants to enjoy his pit and eat his meal, a little bit of wine and some fiddle music. But you can't do that without going out into the world and enjoying other people and doing what you can for them. That's the way he enjoys his life. He doesn't know when it's going to happen the next day. He only has enough for today. That's all. But he's okay with that. He trusts God. Almost, not because of anything in particular. It's just like, what's the alternative? What could be other than trusting God? Right? But what other possible way would there be? What's the question? Things are the way they are. How do you not trust that things are the way they are? What is the alternative to that? Given that, he does what he can. And then, as we saw, the story gets a little darker. He has to join the army. When I first mentioned that, several of you cringed, oh no, you know, where's this story going? He's joining the army, what's going to happen? The army is always a tense thing, you know, violence, tragedy. Maybe the fixer would get killed or have to kill somebody else. This doesn't seem to be a time of war, so that's not the question here, but it's pretty drastic when he's asked to execute someone. Now, doesn't it seem clear? Just sort of seems like obvious that God doesn't want us killing one another. Doesn't that seem like pretty clear? That whatever religion you believe in or don't believe in, whatever your ethical system, I mean, I'm sure there's somewhere there's an ethical system that says let's always be at war and kill everybody we don't like, but it's got to be rare. You don't meet many people who have that idea. Right? It seems to be a universal thing about human beings with any sense of ethics or caring. We don't want to kill each other. We're supposed to love one another. And if we don't, we're trying to work at that. We're supposed to care for one another. And if we don't, we're working on it. Even our enemies, right? We're supposed to learn how to understand them and somehow accept them. I mean, it seems like pretty obvious that God would like the world to be tamed. God would like our violence to be tamed. Doesn't it? I mean, and yet, when did we not have war? Somebody brought this up the other day. How could it be, you know, this morning that is brought up? How could it be? When everybody knows this and everybody teaches this, how could it be that we always have war? So there's killing all the time. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants this. Nobody says, this is a great idea. Nobody wants it. And yet, we say, sometimes we can't help it. Sometimes we're forced into it. We don't want to kill, but sometimes we have to do it, we say. Because if we don't kill, we will be killed. So I don't want to do it, but I have to do it. In this case, the fixer is not in danger of being killed. He's asked to kill someone else. And he doesn't want to kill anybody. And I think these two things go hand in hand. It just seems like in the story, it's sort of axiomatic. A person with perfect faith in God doesn't want to kill anyone. That's it. And won't kill anyone. He seems to love everyone. And he's peaceful. Well, the story ends in a kind of joke. And even the king, who's done all these terrible things after all to this poor guy, laughs at the joke. I guess, you know, maybe we could say the fixer outsmarted the king. In the end, the king yielded to the fixer because the fixer's perfect faith, you know, overcame the king's desire and ability to screw him up. There's not really any darkness in the story. Because he lives in the pit, because he's not trying to avoid the pit, because he knows how to live in the pit, he lives in peace. He has absolutely nothing whatsoever to protect. The only thing he has is today. Today and perfect faith in God. And because he has nothing to protect and nothing that he possesses, he doesn't have to kill anyone. Even when he goes into the army and straps on a sword, he doesn't have to kill anyone. I'm aware that Rabbi Nachman's stories usually have very deep and complex underlying symbols and many mystical levels that I don't really understand. So I'm reading this story on a very simple level, upon the level of the Peshat, you know. And to me, I actually think that it's a wonderful model of how to live a religious life. You may say, what a nice fairy tale. But who could ever try to live like that? I think all religious ideals are fairy tales in that sense, right? But I don't think we laugh them off or dismiss them. I think we should aspire to be like the fixer. I really do. Maybe we can't quite manage it, but I think we can go walking in that direction. Maybe the example of the fixer is like the horizon that we're always walking toward, and maybe we never reach it, but that doesn't mean it's not really, really good to go that way. Sounds a little impractical, I guess, to be like that. But then again, religious people are always impractical. To really be good, to really have faith in this world the way it is highly impractical. But maybe we've had enough practicality to last us many, many lifetimes. Maybe more of us should become impractical. So that's the story of the fixer. I always enjoy listening to Jeff talk about language and duality, and because I love to think about language. I've also been, Jeff and I share that. We've both been thinking about language for many, many decades. And I don't think he said this, but it sounds like, from what he's saying, right, that like we should cut our heads off. This language and the human conceptual thinking is the whole problem. We'd be better off if we were cows, you know? But don't forget that in Jewish mystical thought, the whole world is created by words and letters, literally. That's where the world comes from, right? So if on the one hand, language and concept is inherently dualistic, on the other hand, language is a mystery. And out of words and letters come everything that exists. So that's my excuse to read you a poem. And this this is actually not a poem, it's the prelude to a book of mine. All my books of poetry are obscure. But this one is really, really obscure. Because I made the mistake of, this book was published in France, which I thought was a great idea, because then I could go to France and, you know, it was published by University Press, who did a series some years ago where it was a series in American poetry, American poets, and they would, they would publish your book and then translate it in French and simultaneously put out two books, one in French, one in English, and then they would invite you to the university and blah, blah. So it was fun. I went and did this. But I didn't realize that the trouble with that is that the distribution of this university press from France in the U.S. is terrible. So nobody's ever even heard of this book. It's too bad. It's called On a Train at Night. And it's all about what I just said. It's all about how the whole world is created from language. And so it's an acrostic serial poem. A whole bunch of poems beginning with the letter A, the letter B, the letter C. It goes through the whole alphabet, and it's all poems beginning with those letters. And this is the prelude, or what do they call it, the preface or something like that. Prologue. This is the prologue to the book. It's a little long, but I'm going to read you the whole thing. And I will hold the mic, yeah. And let me know if not. Thank you for letting me know there. So this is the prologue to On a Train at Night. In the beginning, by 10 utterances, by mere statement of intention, by words, even the words, in the beginning, we have learned. Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Natan say, by a single utterance was it created as it is written, for he speaks, he writes, and it is written, by this it is created, not 10, but a single utterance. But how can this be? One utterance only. By the sea, within the sea, under, above the sea, the cloud, the broom, that's B-R-U-M-E, the broom, the chaos before the sea, in this and any language, by the wind, within the wind, under, over, and above the wind, as it is written, by the shuddering wind, by the breaking of great trees in shrouded distances, by shrouded distances themselves, within, below, beyond, close and far above, by the known and unknown in single incalculable utterance, even a single letter, even a sounded exhale, by the wind hovers tenebrous over hooded waters. Sorry, even a single exhale, by the wind hovers tenebrous over hooded waters. Each exhale, incendiary expiration of being, disappearance within utterance, single letter sounded ha. As house opening at left top under roof and from below, through which rushes the yet to be. Opening above, opening below, unenclosed, breached disclosure. Shelter hint, heaved from inconclusive crenels in the mind, without shelter, without rest, settling dwelling, inclined, speechless letter sound of eternal, unpronounceable name, undeniable, because inexistent, so eternally, potentially plausible. Exhale, dark dot mouth shape, inhales, slashed letter line, exhales, 1,000 broken worlds, inhales, slashed gash, exhales, unutterable syllable, sibilance only, hisses, speechless as it is written, violence in air, colorless and void, beasts, fishes, plants, stone, exhaled as open, shelter, snakes, hiss, black fire, on white, broom, black broom, consumed in white fire, beyond, above, beneath, within, violence, as shape, letter, sound, black, gash, neither this nor that, neither that nor otherwise, neither being nor not. Characters unleash their tendencies, insects swarm desert mounds, pure, pure. Rabbi Eleazar said, the Holy One took a letter from his name, and by this letter it was created. Who is like you? What can be likened to what? It is like a star, a bandit, a bush, a twig. What can be likened to what? To what can utterance be likened? Yet an extra letter extracted from the name and added here. Creek, ravine, spring, fountain, boulder cannot be likened nor depicted. Green, chaotic, firmament sways above the waters, created but not manifest, as if to be but not yet having been, not yet being, having been being present, not yet having come to be, because there is yet no other required for the being one against one, two in single letter, not the first nor yet last. For every creation is revealed according to its light, must be eternal delight in own light, must be passion, must be destruction, must be grasping, must be hurling down for itself, in yet itself, toward another, yet as itself. Rabbi Yehuda said, the heavens and the earth were finished in their own time. Rabbi Nehemiah said, these are the generations throughout time when they were created. On that day they brought forth all the generations at that time, as time is not yet a cloud moving across the sky in which beings are muffled and cold, nor time yet a mountain upon which beings climb one side and descend the other. All generations created at a single moment, a single hour, a single day, in letters, words, an evening and morning, one day, a second, a third, a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, like fig gatherers, tenders of the olive tree, each appearing yet in own time. Rabbi Berechiah said in support of Rabbi Nehemiah, the earth brought forth something already inside her. Nothing brings forth nothing already yet inside her, not the unspoken word not yet written by the absent author of heaven and earth created on a sleepless day. Rabbi Akiba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, before the Blessed One created the world through his utterance, he and his name were one. Words, their realities, their souls, none articulated but winds howling through picture forests, punctuation marks indicating stops and frets, crawled and wept. It arose in his mind to create a world. He sang 1,000, as it is written, the thousands are yours, and sang others to show all worlds as mirage. So the first letter Aleph raised 1,000 inexistent worlds, Beit, a dwelling which caressed worlds after destruction, Gimel, garden of peaceful abundance, fourth letter, the human living in four directions, and what can be said? Wind over water, sound over significance. Rabbi Yitzchak said in the name of Rabbi Zrika, green seeping chaos streaks surround abyss, ascend and descend through language time as the other who cried out and was subdued. Letter expanded along four radii upon abyss, undulating sand rills, broken letters heaped up, as we have learned, for it is written, one within the other, 1,000 worlds proceeded. Glory rang out as two letters arose, three letters engraved below, nested within, one engraved became three, three, four, four became two, there were yet 10, 10 divide, become 32. 22 and 10 divide, becoming 42. 42 become 1,000. 1,000, zero. Zero swallows letters as all. From here we contemplate with trembling heart. We conceal. We fear. You shall describe nothing. You shall explain nothing. All explanation, depiction, coherence, significance is control, is blasphemy. You shall sing in hiddenness. Creation lies in wait, souls in wait, in words, winds, waters, rhymes, night, cisterns, fill. Souls engage in frightful generation. Life pullulates. that's the prologue. And I finish my talk with a very recent little poem just to cleanse the palate, because all that is a bit much, I know. So this is just in the notebook, just from the other day, so it's kind of raw. One last thing to say before I leave. My heart goes out to everyone, got no heart left. So please, return my heart to me before sundown, else I'm forced to procure another from unseemly places. What sense can it make to state this or that truth in the face of an eagle in flight above the scorched landscapes, soaring, crooked, and graceful in unspeakable power? I pray for help in a hard time, for mercy against shoddy deeds and against the grain. Who needs me now and then? And to whom do I owe another shattering day? Oh you. Where do I place my hope, and how shape today's conduct against the grain, or with the grain, if not in you? Oh, you. Oh, you. A heart's a fragile thing of glass or soap or water, but soldiers on a while, a whole life through. For you, oh, for you in the bright interior. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I love to read my poems, so you did me a favor. Thank you. I do it because there's at least one poet in the room. Probably more. Have a good dinner, everyone.